KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this next hour of Forum, a never-before-heard pre-recorded interview with novelist Philip Roth. We talk about his newest novel, Exit Ghost, and we begin after news from National Public Radio. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to a pre-recorded edition of the Forum program. Exit Ghost is Philip Roth's 28th book. Zuckerman's Final Ordeal, as it's put in the book, concerns fiction writer Nathan Zuckerman, whom readers first met in the 1979 novel The Ghostwriter, and who has been in rural seclusion in the Berkshires for over a decade. When this newest Roth novel opens, we find Nathan in Manhattan, post-operative from prostate cancer surgery, and looking into the possibility of an operation that might cure his incontinence. In New York, he meets the aging and infirm Amy Bellette, the once enchanting young woman we first met in The Ghostwriter, and a young couple he decides to switch residence with, and an ambitious young literary biographer who seeks to expose a longtime secret of Nathan's mentor and Amy Bellette's former lover, novelist E.I. Lanoff. But how can a brief summary of plot and the cast of characters ever hope to approximate the power of a Philip Roth novel, or the novelist who has won two National Book Awards, a Penn Faulkner, and a National Book Critics Circle Award? In 1997, Philip Roth won the Pulitzer for American Pastoral, and in 1998, he was a recipient of the White House Gold Medal of Arts, and in 2002, he received the Gold Medal in Fiction. We had the good fortune of talking with him about his two previous novels, Every Man and The Plot Against America, and he joins us for this pre-recorded Forum Hour. And welcome back, Philip Roth.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleased to have you. And maybe how to move from the last interview to the present one, that is From Every Man to Exit Ghost. And I'm looking actually in my book, which was just released, which does have a portrait of you, a portrait where I admit to fawning a little at the end of the interview. And I said that Philip Roth explains his new novel is grim, but affirmative of life's sweetness, heightened consciousness, bliss, and love. The newest seems grim and not so affirmative. Would that be a fair characterization?
I think so, yeah. Zuckerman has been very ill, as you said, with prostate cancer. He has had surgery to remove the prostate. The consequence of the surgery has been incontinence and impotence. And two great blows to self-esteem, to put it mildly. And now he winds up in New York, as you say, to have a procedure which will hopefully correct something of the incontinence. I wouldn't say that death hovers over the book, but illness hovers over the book, and loss hovers over the book.
There's a sense in the book of also not only that loss hovering, a very poignant sense of loss hovering, ubiquitous almost, but of the real contrast between age and youth, because we have, on the one hand, Amy Bellette, whom I mentioned in my introduction, someone Zuckerman knew in his youth, and we have Jamie, who becomes a love interest of his, and then we have Nathan Zuckerman himself and a young, rather brash piece of literary lice, as I think he might refer to him, yes. Named Clayman. And so we have what are kind of dichotomized, if there is such a word, as not yets and no longers.
Yes, that's what Zuckerman calls them. His group he calls no longers, and the youngsters he calls not yets. Yeah, there is a vivid contrast between the youngsters, the people in their 30s, late 20s and 30s, and Zuckerman and Amy, who are the oldsters. And the book is, in one way, about not just aging and illness, but enduring aging and illness, and the strategies that people develop in order to endure. And even the young people have to have strategies. After all, Jamie, the young woman whose apartment Zuckerman wants to swap for, her strategy to escape her fears of terrorists striking New York again, is to get out to the country and live out in the woods.
Well, Zuckerman, to some extent, lives out in the woods also as a kind of strategy against at least some rank anti-Semitism that he encountered.
Well, Zuckerman moved to the country, yes, in some 10 years before this book opens, because of death threats that he received. Yes, they were decidedly anti-Semitic, rather brutal correspondence that he got, and that continued over a period of time, and that involved the FBI and helping him to try to figure out how to deal with them. And his solution finally was to leave New York, not that he would be safer necessarily in the rural countryside, but that's what he felt, so that's what he did.
We're talking with Philip Roth, his new novel, Exit Ghost. In fact, there's one point in the novel where he meets a man whom he believes may be the perpetrator of these threats, but there's a great ambiguity to whether or not, in fact, that is the case.
Well, I think it's fact he isn't the guy. The guy couldn't have been responsible, but Zuckerman is paranoid on the issue of these death threats, and it's still in his mind some 8 or 9 years after the event.
Is this a kind of binary way that we ought to see the novel, that is, giving us different strategies for youth by contrast to different strategies for those who are ill and moving into their later years?
Yeah, I think you can read it that way.
And also, you talk about Lost. There's a lot about what he calls the reading-writing people, the no-longers, perhaps, and the sense that there may be ghosts witnessing, or we're all witnessing, the end of what I guess can be described as a literary era.
Well, that comes out, that point of view that you just mentioned, comes out in a long letter that Amy Bellette has written to the New York Times cultural pages, in which she bemoans the fate of the reception of books and how they're received.
And old age, the dying animal that we all are, I'm sort of recapitulating in my mind whether we have Zuckerman going gently or raging against the dying of the light.
Well, he discovers in coming to New York that he thinks he still wants to live with people. I don't know whether that's raging against the dying of the light. He's discovering an impulse that he thought he'd long since killed. And there's the impulse to be in it. And that impulse reasserts itself. And it's clobbered to bits in just a week, and he retreats as quickly as he can to his hermit-like existence.
What I extrapolate from that is that it may be impossible to really kill that, that even though he has a transcendent calling as a novelist and he turns sentences around, as Lanoff did, in a kind of ascetic way up there in the Berkshires, there's still some kind of desire, loneliness, longing that will always be vestigial, always be there?
Absolutely, yeah.
And is he kind of a Jake Barnes figure with Jamie? That is a man who can't perform and yet who has this longing and can't consummate it even if she were willing.
Well, I think I go into the struggle with impotence in more detail than Hemingway does in The Sun Also Rises. I always found that part of the book in The Sun Also Rises sort of underwritten. But to be sure, I reread the book when I was writing my own, reread The Sun Also Rises. Yeah, he's in Jake Barnes and Zuckerman are in the same boat. It's a terrible boat to be in, and the strength of the loss has not been felt by him so long as he's lived away. Once he comes back and sees this attractive young woman, then he feels the strength of the loss, and even tries to pretend to himself that the loss doesn't exist.
In fact, there's always been so much made out of, or attempts to make out of your book and autobiography, and we know that Hemingway was drawn to Lady Duff Twisdon, whom Brett Ashley was based on, and that Hemingway wasn't wounded in the groin or anything. He just felt that as a married man, he couldn't take up with her. There are all these attempts to explore, again, how much of this is Philip Roth and how much of Zuckerman is Philip Roth. And in a sense, the book is an answer to that, as a number of your books have been, which is whoever these people are who are barking up that tree should stop their barking.
How is the book an answer to that?
Well, because I think that Kleiman thinks he's found a secret to the work of Lanoff. And in finding that secret and exposing that secret, he's going to somehow capture the essence of who Lanoff was and what his gift of writing was all about. And, of course, it may have nothing to do with that. And, in fact, that has to be protected and certainly is protected within the novel as being private.
Well, the biographical quest will always go on. I'm a great reader myself of literary biographies. I just finished Hermione Lee's massive but wonderful book on Edith Wharton. So a lot of it depends on the quality of the biographer. I think between, say, someone like Hermione Lee and Kleiman, there are miles and miles. The problem with the biographical approach to reading is that generally it replaces the reading. That is, all the critic who's interested in that can tell you about as well. A parallels B in the writer's life and C parallels D. But then you say, what about the book? What do you make of the book? And there's little to be said. So that's my own frustration with it.
Another frustration that I thought of in reading your book, your newest book, and that is I couldn't help thinking almost like involuntary memory of the fact that there is a secret supposedly attached, similar to the one you write about in the book, to the novelist, the great Call It Sleep novelist, Henry Roth. And when I read Ghostwriter, like many of the readers of Ghostwriter, I was thinking, is Lanoff Malamud, is Lanoff Singer? And then I kind of slapped myself for thinking along those lines, because it's an easy way, it seems to me, to try to get at something other than what the fiction gets at.
Yes, I agree with you. It's an easy way not to read.
Exactly. Or not to think, maybe. Yeah. Or both.
And yes, yes. There are many easy ways not to think, though, Michael. There are legion. people have... I just read a biography of Malamud, as a matter of fact, by a man named Davis, brought out by Oxford University Press in England. I think it's coming out here soon. He has a whole chapter in his book devoted to the ghostwriter and Malamud, and he's dead wrong. There are a few habits of Malamud that I borrowed for to characterize my man, Lanoff, but it had nothing to do with Malamud or Malamud's wife, for that matter. It bears no relationship whatsoever to the wife and the ghostwriter. So there's often an attempt to associate a character with some well-known name, as though the only people that the writer knows are celebrities, and the only ones he can draw on are celebrities. But one has many, many acquaintances. One hears many, many stories. One observes many, many lives, and they're not just the names of people in the news.
Talking with Philip Roth, author of The Ghostwriter, notwithstanding the Wharton biography and others of that caliber, this incessant rummaging around in psychobiography, I think, angers you, doesn't it?
Oh, I'm getting weary of being angry. it wearies me.
I certainly understand that. And I remember an essay you did many years ago about how the real news and what's in the everyday papers defies our imaginations or really challenges our imaginations, because in some ways they can't meet up. Our imaginations almost can't meet up to what's in the news and what's on the daily telly, as they say in the UK. I mean, are you still of that mind?
Well, that essay came out of a talk I gave at Stanford in 1960 or 1960. So that's now 47 years ago, and things have changed. The thesis of that lecture, essay, was that I had been reading books that had come out in that year and the year before, and noticed that these books tended to focus very strongly on the private lives of the characters, and that the large social and political themes of our lives were addressed by and large not by the first-rate writers who were writing these books about the self, but by lesser novelists who made the public scene their own. And I was doing nothing but commenting on it. I had no axe to grind. Yes, it was a phenomenon I pointed to. So much has happened in those 47 years, I wouldn't know where to begin to address the subject.
David Mamet once said that going back to earlier work, especially when it's about 40 years old, is like going back to your old refrigerator or something along those lines. Does that metaphor make sense to you?
Yes, very good.
We're talking again with Philip Roth. His new book is Exit Ghost, all about the ghost, what Zuckerman calls the ghost of my desire. This is a haunting ghost. This is reminded of the great psychoanalyst Winnicott, who says we must make our ghosts into ancestors. Is that what we need to do with ghosts of desire as well?
Well, I don't know that line. That's very good. I don't know what we must do or mustn't do. All I know is that Zuckerman is visited by what he calls the ghost of his desire when he meets Jamie. And Zuckerman is himself a kind of ghost when he comes back to New York. He doesn't inhabit it wholly. He's he's a returning ghost. And he's a ghost when he exits, too, at the very end of the book, or rather, I should say, ghost-like. And in New York, he meets Amy, who is herself ghost-like. The past is all she has, and she lives in the 5 or 6 years that she lived with Lanoff, and that's all 30 or 40 years earlier. So these people are either ghost-like or ghostly or are haunted by their memories and or haunted by their longings, as Zuckerman is when he says that he feels the ghost of his desire.
They both also have brains that are in trouble. His is yes. Disordered, his memory is disordered, hers is ravaged by cancer. Is this what we could, if we were teaching literature? I think the last time you and I talked, you said not necessarily teaching literature in the academy like they used to, but is this what we call a metaphor for old age, perhaps, scrambled brain?
I don't know that it's a metaphor. I think it's a fact of old age. There are some people who are spared the disordered mind, but many who aren't, and people have short-term memory loss, or they have long-term memory loss, or they have lapses, they forget things, maybe as simple as going into one room to get something and not remembering what you went for, and maybe something more significant, like not remembering who you spoke to the day before. So I think that it's a hard, nasty fact of aging. There are harder ones and nastier ones, but it's a hard, nasty fact of aging that people's minds get scrambled, and they can no longer rely on memory, which is quite a loss.
And we're talking with novelist Philip Roth about his new book, Exit Ghost. Back in The Ghostwriter, Amy Blitt was identified quite imaginatively, and was an extraordinary act of imagination, I thought at the time, and still do, with Anne Frank. That didn't come back in any way to Zuckerman.
I think that I'm not sure, Michael. I think that at one point either Amy or Zuckerman refers to the fact that he said to her back then, back in the 50s, you bear a resemblance to Anne Frank. But nonetheless, no, it's not a subject here. Here, in fact, you get not the imagined biography that Zuckerman had assigned to young Amy in The Ghostwriter, where he imagined her as an Anne Frank who'd come to live, who survived the camps and comes to live pseudonymously in America. But rather you get Amy's real story, that in fact she's a Norwegian Jew and lost a good deal of her family in the Holocaust as well.
And yet one can't help thinking, you know, serious readers of your work, about that identification with Anne Frank. So to some extent I'm wondering, was it just learning the real story that made it perhaps of subliminal or maybe not important at all?
Well, I was writing about her now. I brought in some of the material from the ghostwriter where I thought it was necessary for the reader to know what had happened when Zuckerman and Amy were young. But I only went so far because otherwise the book would have become cluttered with the ghostwriter and entangled with it in a way that I, for one, couldn't have handled.
So let's talk a bit about who Zuckerman is to you. I mean, there's a lot of assumptions and a lot of analogies made. One of the analogies, maybe because there's a quartet of them, is to Updike's Harry Angstrom, Rabbit. But I kind of see Zuckerman as different, as just really a character who is a fiction writer whom you're drawn to for whatever reasons and who lives to tell stories, and including the stories that you tell that are his own.
Yes, yes, precisely. The Zuckerman is portrayed differently as the books progress. In the first three books, The Ghostwriter, Zuckerman Unbound, The Anatomy Lesson, and then the epilogue to those called The Prague Orgy. It's about somebody, those are books about somebody starting out, and his life is at the center of the books, though there are other people whose lives are important too, as are Lonoff's and Amy's in The Ghostwriter. And then in the center of these nine books is a book called The Counterlife, in which Zuckerman leaves the confines of New York and goes to London and goes to Israel and visits the West Bank and so on. It's sort of Tom and Huck on the road, you know. And then three books that follow are very different. In the American Pastoral and I Married a Communist and The Human Stain, Zuckerman is the mind that shapes the tale and not a player in the action. Only peripherally is he a player in one or two of the books, but mostly he is engaged by the stories of others and sets out to narrate the stories of others. And then this last book, I came back to him and made him the center again, because I wanted to take this illness that I'd given him seriously. Attached the prostate cancer to him when I wrote American Pastoral. And the reason I did that was about the time I was writing that book, I guess I was in my 60s, and as were most of my friends. And suddenly I found that every third friend suddenly had prostate cancer. It was a mini epidemic and quite frightening. And so I thought I would give this disease to Zuckerman because it was of the times and somehow made him of his time. And he lived without sex and even without a female companion during the time that those books take place. When I finally got down to Exit Ghost, I thought the time had come to take seriously, or to investigate seriously, the consequences of that that prostate cancer.
Actually, I'm sorry. I was just going to say we're coming up on a break. Let me come back to this with you, if I may, and also talk about the time, because the 2004 presidential campaign also comes into play in the novel. If you've just joined us, this is a pre-recorded hour with Philip Roth, the author of Exit Ghost, his newest novel, actually his 28th book, and he is, of course, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and one of our best, far and away. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is a pre-recorded hour with novelist Philip Roth. His newest book is called Exit Ghost, and we went to a break there, but before we went to the break, he was explaining really how he came to the present moment in terms of his character Nathan Zuckerman's life, and I'm sorry to have interrupted you, Philip Roth, but please continue if you would.
Yeah, well, I had said mostly what I have to say, which is that I wanted to take Zuckerman's condition as a survivor of prostate cancer and as a man who become incontinent and impotent as a result of the surgery, and play that out and show just how extensive the loss is, explore the pathos and pain of that loss and the humiliation of that loss. And alas, that's what the book attempts to do.
When you were writing the narrative, did you feel in a very deep way what you just described, that is the pain, the pathos, and the humiliation?
No, I don't feel it. I try to present it, what I feel is the effort to make the presentation clear and salient.
You've, in your early career, often were described in various ways, both literal and figurative, as a phallocentric writer. And what is a loss of phallic power, if you will, or potency, really mean for a man like Nathan Zuckerman? Does it mean that, to some extent, it's very difficult, if not impossible, for him to get back into life in the way that he had been before? Is that where a lot of that power rests?
Well, he's lived away from any temptation. That's one way to deal with the loss, is to keep temptation at bay. And when he decides to stay in New York, he yields to temptation. Maybe it just seems the temptation to stay in the city, but other things are going to follow in its wake. Yes, it's quite a strong loss to suffer for a man or for a woman in a parallel situation. And it speaks of the end of a whole way of life. And it's can be quite compromising.
I think the phrase in the novel is battle fatigue with respect to the world of love. And I was also reminded of someone whom we both admire greatly, whom you've written about, and actually so have I, and that's Saul Bellow, who said toward the end of his life, when he was asked if he'd do anything really differently, he said, I wouldn't have been so involved with women as I was.
Is that what he said?
That's what he said, yeah. I couldn't help thinking about that and reading about Zuckerman. Maybe maybe Zuckerman felt the same way, I thought. Perhaps not. What about the 2004 presidential campaign, though? That comes into play here.
Yeah, that's the backdrop for one of the early scenes in the book. Zuckerman is invited by young Jamie and her husband to come and spend election eve with them. Or it's not election eve, I guess it's election night, with them while the results come in. And they've already agreed to exchange their apartment for his house in the country. And they watch Kerry go down to defeat, much to the distress of young Jamie and her husband, Billy. Zuckerman, on the other hand, has opted out of concern about things political and social and cultural. He doesn't take a newspaper. He doesn't read a magazine. He doesn't watch television news. Has separated himself from all of those things. So there's a very strong contrast drawn between Zuckerman, who has had enough of all that, and these young people who are badly shocked by what happens.
Yeah, he is in some ways really, some would say, a Luddite, particularly when he comes to Manhattan and sees all these cell phones, some very funny riffing about his reaction to that, but an anachronism.
Yes, yes.
And I want to phrase this delicately, there's not the humor in this book that there often is in Philip Roth novels.
You don't have to phrase it delicately.
Well, let me get, I'm being protective toward you, forgive me for being so presumptuous, but, you know, you're a very funny writer and you have, you know, created some wonderful humorous moments in your novels in my life, and yet it's sparing, as you seem
yes.
to.
Yes, yes, it's a grim atmosphere in the book, and I knew it when I was writing it. I didn't see any occasions for humor. I think there was probably a scenario almost equally grim in every man. When you're writing about illness and death and loss and desperation, it's humor isn't the first thing that that comes to mind. I know it's different from other works of mine, but that's okay.
Do you ever go back and read the earlier work that you've done?
Not usually, I don't know.
So I remember having a discussion with you many years ago. In fact, I mentioned it in our first interview about an early story of yours, You Can't Tell a Man by the Song That He Sings, and you seem to be almost protective toward that story, or certainly had kind of a loving father attitude toward it.
Well, I'm a loving father, but I don't see my children very often.
I'm wondering, in fact, if you did see your children, you know, especially now at this stage of your life, if you would see them differently than when you saw them when you gave birth to them.
Yeah. Oh. Sure. I think what happens when you read your old work is all you see is are the flaws, mm-hmm. And the youth. It's embarrassing and just seems a waste of time.
Talking again with Philip Roth, his newest novel, Exit Ghost. Last February, I did an interview on stage with Norman Mailer. It may have been his last, and we just played excerpts in the wake of his death of that interview. And he spoke of you actually rather fondly and admiringly. He said, I should have read more Roth. I didn't. I was envious of many writers and felt, you know, I needed a battle with them. But Roth was one who I felt was really one of the greats. And in discussing his last novel, there was a period where he was writing about, it's a novel about Hitler. He was writing about Hitler, and then suddenly we're taken to the Russian Revolution. And I thought to myself, that's very interesting that he should suddenly feel compelled for whatever reason to move to the Russian Revolution. And he said, well, I just felt like it, so I did it in there. Mm-hmm. I wondered about your moving to George Plimpton, as you did, and if that was just kind of the memory and spirit of just moving to George Plimpton.
Well, I to paraphrase Norman, I felt like it, so I did it. I think it belongs, however, I hope so. Near the end of a book, I like always for something new to explode. as you get down to the end, you can often just be tying the threads together, but I like there to be something that pops up that's brand new out of nowhere, and Plimpton popped up there in the last chapter. What happens is that Kleiman reveals to Zuckerman something he didn't know, that George Plimpton was dead. And it's a peculiar thing when someone's been dead for a year and you just find out about it. There's even sometimes a greater shock than if you found out at the time of the death. And so Zuckerman, who knew Plimpton, is greatly shocked by it and ruminates on Plimpton, the man, Plimpton the writer, and the relationship between Plimpton's background and the world of journalism that he covered.
Yeah, it's a kind of rumination of a novelist on a journalist, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And he remembers with delight all the things that George Plimpton did, and then who was a journalist and who entered 10 different worlds a week, and then he thinks, why didn't I do them? And the reason is that he was a novelist who does one thing for 3 years, and that is work on a book. So George Plimpton hovers over that part of the book in part as a harbinger of death, in part as a kind of judgment on Zuckerman's life. And lastly, I'd say there's just a general appreciation of his work that's laid down by Zuckerman.
And of the man.
Yes, the man.
Yeah.
To be sure.
And I was also struck by just the thought of all of those different, I don't know, call them incarnations or avatars, whatever, that we associate with Plimpton, you know, taking on all these different identities in order to write about them, and going back in my mind as a reader of your work and thinking of all the different selves and lives and counter-lives of Nathan Zuckerman.
Good.
There's also, in Exit Ghost, a lot of dialogue. Nathan Zuckerman goes to some lengths to get down imaginative dialogue about what might have happened if he had become engaged with Jamie or she with him, and Kleiman comes into this in a triangle fashion. I remember a book of yours quite well called Deception, which was a book that had a shorter life than some of your work, certainly, but that was all dialogue. And I'm just wondering about the difference between working with dialogue exclusively, with he-she, like you did in part of this novel, and doing it, in effect, as you did in Deception, to, well, embrace the whole novel, really.
Yeah. I no longer, I remember Deception, what's in it. I no longer remember the impulses behind it. But I do remember the impulses behind the dialogues, these little playlets that appear in Exit Ghost. What I wanted to do was to dramatize Zuckerman's longing. And it isn't enough just to say, I felt the ghost of my desire, but I wanted him to enact it and to feel some of the agony of the flirtation, which is what these dialogues amount to. He invents scenes between himself and Jamie in which she delights him and tortures him simultaneously by talking about her sexual past, by flirting, and all of this excites in him his loss and his desire and his desperation. So those were, for me, the manifestation of the agonies of his loss.
I don't know if you saw a review that I thought was quite unfair to the novel that appeared in The Atlantic by Christopher Hitchens, but he said that these dialogues were, I think he referred to them as being masturbatory, and was curious to know what your response is to that kind of insight, quote-unquote.
I didn't see it, and I have no response.
I mentioned Deception. At the end of Deception, the character goes back to New York, and he embraces the vitality of New York and the life of it, and says he realized he missed Jews. That is, he missed the Jews of New York. Yeah, in Deception. And in this last, or maybe the last, I don't know yet, this most recent Zuckerman novel at any rate, I'll have to ask you if it's the last one, there is a sense of his longing just for engagement in life. What about the Jewish content here? It seems to be, again, there are more traces of it than there is visibility of it.
Well, there's what the aspect of the book you pointed out earlier, which is the death threats, which are anti-Semitic in content, virulent in their language and tone, and threatening. AK-47 is a word that comes up repeatedly in these letters. And those are directed at Zuckerman as a Jew. As you remember, Jamie's husband, Billy, tells a story about how Jamie's father was against her. They're Houston arch Republicans. How Jamie's father was against her marrying Billy because Billy is a Jew. So the fact that these the two men in the book, the three men actually, are Jewish is alluded to when it's of some moment and not alluded to when it isn't.
Has there been a trajectory, do you think, though, in your work in terms of just Jewish identity becoming maybe... Well, since you started writing really after the Second World War, when the shadow of the Holocaust was still so preeminent, and when Jewish identity was also much more perhaps preeminent than it is now, that the changes have occurred.
Well, I have to tell you, I never thought I was all that Jewish a writer myself. There's no accounting for the labels that are attached to one. But... when I think of my books, my early books, Letting Go, When She Was Good, then Our Gang and The Breast and Great American Novel and Professor of Desire, they have nothing to do, really, with my being Jewish or the characters being Jewish. So I think there's an aspect of the characters' lives which flows out of the fact that they're Jews, but it's not the dominant subject of the books, as far as I can tell.
Actually, I think it was Bella who said, you know, I'm a Jewish writer in the way that a fish is in water, and sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. You mentioned Arguing and The Breast and The Great American Novel. There were a trio of novels that seemed really highly experimental, like you were really engaging in some Swiftian satire and having a lot of fun. Why do you suppose we just saw that come about kind of as a triumvirate triad, if you will, and then no more of those kind of novels?
Well, it was they were preceded by yet another book that was might be thought of as, to borrow your word, Swiftian. That was Portnoy's Complaint, which had a strong satiric streak. So there are those four books, and they come out of a period from about 1968, 67, when I was writing Portnoy's Complaint, till about 1975, when the other books were written and published. So it's about a 6 or 7 year period in my late 30s. And I remember at the time, first of all, the 60s had just happened, and I was as ignited as the next person, you know. And exaggeration, spoof, mockery, ridicule had their day in the 60s. And I was not untouched by the ethos. And, yes?
No, go ahead, please.
And at the time, I remember I wanted to find out how far I could go. After writing Portnoy's Complaint, when I was writing Our Gang and then The Breast and then The Great American Novel, I wondered, how far can you go with this comedy or with farce? What will it release if you just keep pushing on it and pushing on it? I wrote a long story at that time. It was published in the New American Review called On the Air. It's
I remember it well.
It's a truly disgusting story. And
I wouldn't characterize it that way. Well, a very funny story, actually. Yeah.
Well, it was funny. And also disgusting. And I remember clearly I was trying to say, how far can you go with this? So the experiment was my own. It wasn't a literary experiment, really. It was just experimenting with my own sense of comedy and the ridiculous.
In reading Exit Ghost, I was reminded of a Borges story, and I wonder if this sometimes occurs to you, because it seems to filter into your work, either for Zuckerman or for Philip Roth, for that matter, or both. And that is, this is a story that takes place in a park in Buenos Aires, and Borges meets a young man and is talking to him, and he finds the young man rather brash and somewhat arrogant, but smart and engaging, and then he realizes it's a former self of his. Uh-huh. And he realizes he warms to him, but he also doesn't like him. There are things about him that he doesn't like. I wonder if that resonates for Zuckerman or for Philip Roth.
What is the name of that story?
I'm going blank. It's in Labyrinth, but maybe in Ficciones. I'll have to hunt it down and send it to you. It's been many years now. It just popped into my mind, and I trust that kind of impulse.
Sounds quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have it in this very book, in Exit Ghost, when Zuckerman is assaulted first by Kleiman. He thinks this is more or less the way this rambunctiousness, this cocksuredness, verbal attack, he thinks this is more or less the way I did it when I was starting out. So he does see a bit of a former self in Kleiman. I don't know about my own real former selves. I can't keep track.
Actually, Kleiman reminded me a little bit of the character in Operation Shylock, whose name is Philip Roth.
Is that right?
As opposed to the actual Philip Roth, yeah.
Oh, that guy, that's right, yeah. Moshe Pipik,
right, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he bugs him. He's that person who bugs you, yeah.
And in fact, that kind of bugging person turns up from time to time in your work. Not exactly a schnorrer, but almost a folk-like a character that gets under the skin, certainly.
Yes, yes. Well, in the early days of my brilliant career, I was really accosted on the street quite a bit by people who took issue with my rendering of Jews, and with my rendering of sex, and they had all kinds of quarrels. And so I would be accosted by angry people, not every day, mind you, but from time to time, which is enough. And people could be funny, too. They could, I remember after Portnoy's complaint, someone shouting at me across the street, "You're going to get in trouble."
Well,
hold back. I was in trouble.
I don't know if this is, well, it's different than being accosted on the street, but you were accosted in print, particularly by one of the high and mighty canonic elders of that day, Irving Howe. And to some extent, a lot of what happened to Zuckerman with the Karnofsky book had mm-hmm. interesting parallels to that, certainly.
Sure.
How do you regard someone like Howe now?
Irving has been dead now about 10 years.
Yeah.
And I regard him the way any writer who's been fiercely attacked, and it was a fierce attack in about 1973, I think it was, 74. I regard him with the way most writers do anybody who attacks them like that. They're not happy about it. You always have a, you don't forget. One of the reasons you don't forget is that as you become older as a writer, you don't develop thick skin. You have no skin. And so I try to avoid reading reviews. You mentioned Hitchens' review. I didn't read it.
Because there's an old line of Jewish Alzheimer's is forgetting everything but the grudges. You've probably heard that.
Well, I think, you know, not just writers are afflicted with grudges, but writers certainly, I don't know what you talked to Norman about on the stage, but if you had just said the word grudges, I think he could have spoken for an hour or two.
We actually talked about an earlier encounter he had with one of our own local literary celebrities here in San Francisco, Herbert Gold, and I heard both of their stories, but it amounted pretty much to the same thing, kind of a alpha male square-off back in those days where Norman asked Herb Gold to step outside, and Herb went out with him, took off his glasses, and then Mailer said, "You're all right, kid," you know, and that was how they made peace and became friendly, and the friendship uh-huh. apparently stayed during the years. But there was that, among many of you literary lions of that period, there was a kind of fierce competition and testosterone going strong.
Well, I think that Norman's generation is a little different from mine, and Herb Gold, I think, falls somewhere in between. Norman was 10 years older than I am. And
Herb was just 80, just recently.
Herb was just 80. So he's right between the two of us. I'm 74, and Norman was 84 when he died. I think the fellows who served in World War II, the ones who were born around Mailer's time, 1923, who served in the war in 44, 45 at the end of the war, came back from the war, came back into a literary environment which was dominated by Ernest Hemingway. And Hemingway was nothing if not pugilistic, charmingly belligerent and uncharmingly belligerent. And I think he set the kind of standard for how a male writer is supposed to act. He's supposed to drink, he's supposed to be antagonistic and rivalrous, and Hemingway was. Competitive, etc. The generation that I fall into, if we can speak of 10 years as a generation, is my people who are my age are John Updike and Joyce Carol Oates and Reynolds Price. And I don't think our lives have been colored by that ferocious rivalry. I don't mean that we're angels or models of generosity. But I think that it isn't so manifest, the rivalrous and competitive aspect of writing.
And we're talking to Philip Roth about his newest novel, Exit Ghost. And do you know if there will be another Zuckerman novel, or have we exited from Zuckerman?
I think we've exited, yeah.
And You mentioned Hemingway, and I don't know if anybody's asked you this, but there are many who felt, even now with Doris Lessing being this year's recipient of the Nobel Prize, it's long been deserved by Philip Roth. Can I get you on the record about the Nobel?
No.
You've won just about everything else. It would be nice, wouldn't it?
Well, sure, it would be nice. It'd be nice if the sun shone tomorrow, too.
Let's hope it does. I'm going to not necessarily end with sunshine here. We've been talking about a novel that's certainly grim in many ways, but I was reminded, since this is going to play after Thanksgiving, right after Thanksgiving, about American Pastoral and the connection to Thanksgiving, and I was thinking how fortunate we are to have that novel as well as your oeuvre. And again, I promised myself I would try to refrain from any fawning. Let me just say that I'm thankful that you are with us, and I hope you stay with us a long time and continue to be as productive as you've been, which is in itself extraordinary.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Philip Roth, author of the new novel Exit Ghost, and we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our whole production staff, Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauerberg and Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Howard Gelman was on the controls today as our engineer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And I remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in line at 415-553-3300. We'll be back at our regular time on Monday, and again, we remind you that we are with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks for being a part of this special pre-recorded edition of Forum, pre-recorded broadcast during the Thanksgiving season, and happy season to all of you, for all of us here at KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.